Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Today in the program, we'll speak with Rebecca Brenner. She lives here in Park City and has written a guide to being a kid and navigating a human life. It's called The Kid's User Guide to a Human Life, Book One, An Open Mind.
Then you may know him as the creator of Sheldon Cooper of The Big Bang Theory, or Emmy Award-winning writer for Futurama, or perhaps a Harvard-trained philosopher who's working on a PhD in philosophy now at Berkeley. He's Eric Kaplan, and he's on a journey, again a philosophical one, looking into the metaphysical existence of Santa. He makes the paradox understandable in a humorous and insightful way.
This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these messages.
Registration is open for late fall classes at Park City Ice Arena.
Join our skating or hockey academy for fun on the ice. We offer skating classes for all ages. Learn to play hockey for athletes 5 to 12 and basic hockey skating for children 4 years old and up.
Don't forget Small and Tall with story time for preschool-aged kids and lunch bunch for adults.
Registration information at 615-5707 or at parkcityice.org. Park City Municipal Corporation is a KPCW supporter and nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, peace and stability aren't typically words associated with the adolescent years, but our guest, Becca Brenner, in her new book, gives kids an insight into how to do just that, feel peace and stability. Brenner is a Park City local. She's written a new book, The Kid's User Guide to a Human Life. It's book one, An Open Mind. It's illustrated by her friend, Brooke Kimmerer, and includes explanations of navigating this life that a 10-year-old can understand. For the past 14 years, Rebecca Brenner has worked to help adults and children live a joyful, stress-free life. She has a PhD in nutrition and currently runs Park City Holistic Health, her own consulting practice. Not only is she an author and speaker, but she teaches yoga and mindfulness classes, further sharing her passion for a healthy lifestyle. Rebecca Brenner, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's nice to have you. Well, I'm holding your book here in my hand. It's a beautifully illustrated book by your friend Brooke, who lives in Jackson, Wyoming. And I wanted to start first with, it's such a great concept. You talk about the chattering mind. What is it, and how does it begin to affect us even as early as the adolescent years or preteen years?
Well, the chattering mind is the discursive mind, that part of you that's always talking. And that part of you that's always talking is really habitual. It's very repetitive. It's what's learned. And we start to identify with that as being who we solely are. And we forget about the other aspects of us, our ability to be open and present and clear and connected to the moment. We really get caught up in this chatter that just goes on and on and on and on and on, and we take that to be who we are.
Aren't kids sort of supposed to be doing that? I mean, kids are in such a developmental stage, right? And I wanted to ask you what the actual target audience for this book is, because Lynn said adolescence, but I kind of got the sense that it was pre-adolescence, sort of maybe elementary school age kids, which to me seems kind of heady stuff to be talking to young kids about. And then there's the thought that kids are supposed to be hyperactive to some degree or doing a lot of things. And I know we've got a different construct these days where everybody's off to the next soccer game. Whereas when I was a child, it wasn't off to the next soccer game, but there was a lot of activity, just maybe self-created activity.
Yes. Well, the book is targeted for 9 to 12-year-olds, but my hope is that it's a series that parents and teachers and counselors will be really involved in, and that it will speak to them too. I say the kid and the inner kid in all of us. And yes, I think it's absolutely important for children to develop a strong sense of self, which a lot of times we link to ego, that talking mind, the chattering mind. But I also think it's really important because as we get older, we get more and more and more solidified in this thinking mind that, again, is learned and habitual and repetitive, passed down a lot of times from family, our community. And it's not the whole story. So I do think it's important to start to seed the idea to children that it isn't the whole story. It isn't who you are completely, and that you do have this innate capacity to be open and present and awake to the present moment. And in actuality, that's what's going to link you back to your real power in your presence, and that the ego, that sense of self, is something that you use consciously as a tool. But when we're unaware of it, it kind of uses us unconsciously. We just get pulled around by the whims of our thinking mind.
So we know as adults that we have very active chattering minds. And since you're a yoga instructor, I think first of all, when I'm at yoga and you're doing the meditative part, or anytime you're meditating, that chattering mind is very active in me. And this is a practice that we try to quell, right? I'm going to go to the store next, and then I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do that. But it seems to me that children, I mean, up until what age do they not have that? Because, you know, we're led to believe, and I think it's true, that children are so in the present. They're focused on what they're doing, and then somewhere along the way they lose that and develop the chattering mind. When do you think they lose it?
I think that as kids start to develop that stronger sense of self, I believe it comes around 5 and 6, and as they move into school more full time, they really start to move into that sense of self, and we really encourage it as a culture. And if we are parents and teachers and counselors that are very much caught up in our own chattering minds, that's of course what we're going to pass along to our kids. But I do think there is the space and the opportunity for all of us to see that that's not the whole story, and that we can have this ability, or we do have this ability, to use it very consciously. So I do think it starts around 5 to 6 as kids move into school and out of the home. And it, you know, as we move further down our life or through our lives, it gets more and more and more and more solidified. If there's no space and no recognition.
Now you deal with a broad audience age-wise. You teach yoga. You have a wellness practice. And so you're dealing with adults and young people all the time. What drew you to write a book that targets the children versus writing a book that targets, say, parents? Because you could take two different avenues or approaches to this same issue. Either you come at it through the parents and try to retrain them to be calmer parents, or you plant the seed with the children, or do you plan to do both?
Well, you know, my husband and I, almost 8 years ago, moved here to Park City a week after we got married. We started new jobs, moved to a new town. We were 27 or 28, and we were here a month. We went on a hiking trip, a camping trip, about a month after we had moved here. And my husband was experiencing some dizziness and just different things that he felt were neurological that he wanted to get checked out when we got home. And I said, absolutely, we can get that checked out, but it sounds to me like these are symptoms of stress. And that got us talking about, you know, what stress is and how it affects your body and what happens to you when you have stress. And that led into a conversation about, why didn't we learn this when we were kids? Why didn't we learn what stress is, how it affects your body, how to be present, how to use your mind consciously, how to be hydrated, how sleep affects you, how nutrition affects you, all the things that myself and my friends have spent the better part of our adult lives trying to learn and master.
But you say adult lives, and why wasn't that brought to you as a child? I mean, I don't think this is brought to any children, quite honestly.
And that's my point. And so that's what excited us. Then we started talking about, gosh, wouldn't it be really cool to have sort of a user guide for kids? And again, these are big concepts, but if we could share them with kids in a way that just seeded that, so that as they got older and got into the real world and started to really deal with their bodies and stress and life, that they would have this seed from the series of books that hopefully would be able to bloom in their lives.
So they have the lexicon, they have the words to define these feelings when the feelings come up. And it's funny, as you're sitting here talking, I was a kid once, I now have teenagers, but they were young once, and I don't really remember as a kid myself or with my kids when those feelings surfaced and what they felt like that are maybe anxiety or stress, but they surface as something else. So help us with that. What does it look like?
Well, you know, I think that the feeling, all feelings that come up are difficult for all of us. We all experience that. So things like anger or worry or fear, you know, in Buddhism, they say the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows that are going to visit us all. And I think we're a culture that really leans heavy towards the 10,000 joys. You know, mm-hmm. we want to really encourage that and be happy and be productive and go and do, which is all great. But to also teach your kids and ourselves that the 10,000 sorrows are a very natural part of life. And here are some tools to navigate that. That when you come up against your own anger or your own fear or your own anxiety, you haven't done something wrong or you aren't doing something wrong, but there are tools for you to work with that. And they actually can be a catalyst for you to know yourself a lot deeper.
That does that resonate with me in raising my children, because I think when I moved here in 1992, my kids were 4 and 2 years old, and I was all about like, okay, we're in this awesome place with just 10,000 joys of, you know, potential joys before all of you, so we should all be really happy now. there was no focus on that other side and the whole picture of, you know, when things get tough and feelings come up at all. I mean, I know I repressed and ignored and denied and sort of demanded that my family do the same
thing.
You
will be happy.
Yes, you will be happy.
Yeah, well, and then when, you know, I'm thinking of my own teenagers now, when they are up against these challenges, it's like you haven't given them the tools or even the words to use. And then you're going to your 16-year-old saying, well, and how do you feel about that? And it's something that they've never had to do before. And so these tools that you're giving in the book are really just so great for that.
Yeah, and that's, I thank you. And that's why I say the kid and the inner kid, because I have the same situation. I mean, I grew up in a really chaotic family and there was alcoholism and drug addiction. And so I certainly wasn't learning these things when I was a kid. And that's what happens. You know, we are kids and we grow up with parents that are doing their best in most cases. And they pass down what they learned from their parents and their parents and their parents. So it is, you know, it's passed down. And so to have something, a tool, or to begin to learn some tools at a younger age, or just be aware of them, that, you know, there is a different way. And for parents, I'm hoping that parents and, again, teachers and counselors will really be involved in reading the books, the series with the with their kids, and that they will, too, get a lot out of it. And it's not just for kids.
I noticed that a lot of the quotes you have here are, you know, Buddhist or Tibetan, or you reference a lot of other cultures and societies. So I'm wondering, have you looked around the world and said, wow, here's a society that does just what I'm trying to introduce? They talk to their children at an early age about the whole picture of emotional feelings. Have you run across that?
You know, I haven't looked at the whole world per se, but my own education is, you know, I've been teaching yoga and mindfulness and studying meditation.
And mindfulness is a Buddhist concept.
It is. It does come from Buddhism. So I've been studying all of that for the last 20 years, and that's personally where I have found just a lot of great tools that make a lot of sense, that are really rational and applicable to my life. That speaks to me, and so that's what I brought into my writing.
And what did it take to distill those concepts that resonate with you as an adult at this phase of your life down to what you think will resonate with children?
It's interesting because I had a friend as I was starting to write the series who said, you have to be really clear about who your audience is. And she said, even get it down to one single child. Who would that child be? And it instantly came to me. I was like, oh, it'd be myself. It would be myself at 9 to 10 or 11 years old. And so I just imagined that as I was writing the book, what I would have wanted to hear and how I would have wanted to hear it. And then the other layer of that would be, I have two young daughters and what I hope to be able to share with them. So really, that was my focus.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Becca Brenner. She's the author of The Kids User Guide to a Human Life, Book One, An Open Mind. And I just want to read the first paragraph from your introduction. It says, you are magnificent, an adventure of epic proportions, born into this wild adventure called life. This adventure is rich, full of great joy, unbreakable bonds, and unspeakable wonderment. However, it is important to know right from the start that this adventure will also present you with challenges, disappointments, and loss. And there's nothing you can do to change this. It's an intricate part of your journey. When you encounter these challenges, know it is not a reflection of who you truly are. It's just how this adventure of life goes. And that just, I just wanted to read that to give our listeners an idea of kind of where you're going with it. But then you start off in the first chapter with kind of explaining how the brain works. Talk about that.
Well, that was one thing that was huge for me as I was a young adult. And then becoming more of an adult, was dealing with stress and how my thinking mind, my discursive mind, affected my brain, my physical brain, and then my nervous system, and then how that affected my experience of life. And there was something that was so empowering as an early 20-something, late teens, to learn about how I could influence my nervous system.
And where did you learn that? Was that through scientific inquiry or was that more through this philosophical inquiry?
It was more through philosophical inquiry, but there's so much great neuroscience that's coming out that's supporting all of this as
right.
well.
It seems to be supporting what the religions and philosophies have been saying for thousands of years. And now all of a sudden neuroscience is coming along going, oh, now we can scan your brain. And guess what? They were right.
Absolutely. And so there's so much material and I love to read. And so a lot of that is just self-study. But more than anything, it's really been myself working with myself and over the last 20 some years of this journey of becoming a human adult and seeing what really moved me towards health and well-being, and also the last 20 years working with clients. This is really the cornerstone. I do nutrition and yoga with my clients, but it always comes down to the habits of the mind and how we're using them and getting caught up in them and how they're pulling us around. It always comes down to that.
A lot of the scientific data these days and studies is, proving that the adolescent brain is in a high phase of development until right about age 24. 24, 25 is kind of the tipping point where you become hardwired. But up until then, your brain is wiring. So you have this amazing opportunity or challenge, depending on how you want to frame it, to influence what your future is going to look like in a hardwired state. Now, we're also finding out that you can change the hardwiring as you get later into life as well, but it's a lot easier up until age 24. So I would imagine that that's, you know, part of what your focus is with these kids.
Yeah, absolutely. That neuroplasticity is something that we can all work with throughout our entire lives. But you're right, as we are younger, that's where these patterns get imprinted on us physically. Through our brains and into our nervous systems, and then really begin to affect how we see the world and perceive the world. So what a wonderful time to, again, seed this information that you have a lot more power and control over what's going on, and that hard and challenging times and feelings, they're not a bad thing. It's not something to suppress or repress or, you know, try and get around. It's part of it.
Now, I would imagine that in the schools, say the Park City School District, for example, they have little units on something maybe that approaches what you're talking about. But have you approached the schools to see how you can integrate this?
I haven't. I've been in talks with a couple of yoga teachers that work in the schools, and we have been brainstorming some ideas about book clubs or ways that we can begin to incorporate it into the schools. But that I definitely need to do some more work and research with our school district and get in contact with them.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's very interesting. We've recently had a lot of talks with, people in the high school kind of age and about mental illness and how to identify it in your teenager. And it's interesting that there are all these factors that you need to look at. You know, are they dropping their friends? Are they spending more time alone? Are they doing, you know, because I think parents say, well, you know, every teenager gets moody and every teenager, you know, does this, that, and the other. But if they do all 10 of these things at the same time, that's when you really need to be alerted to it. So what it is the parents looking at their teen, but if they had these tools that you're offering here in the book, you know, from the time they're 8, 9, and 10, then maybe the teen would be, you know, informing the parent more than the parent having to be trained on how to recognize some of these issues.
Yeah, and what a wonderful thing to teach our kids to really take their health and well-being into their own hands and have a vocabulary for that and tools for that, that they could then go to their parents or teachers or counselors and talk about what's going on in their chattering mind and how it's affecting them physically, and having the space to see that without fully 100% being lost in it or identified with it. That would be great.
I think it's fabulous to bring these concepts of the chattering mind to the kids, because I mean, I'm just scanning through and seeing things like, you know, you've got a quote on chapter 3 from Byron Katie. You have, you know, Buddha on chapter 2. And it's like, again, these are speaking to me, and I'm 56 years old, and to have been exposed to those sort of thoughts, concepts, and even people at an earlier age is a real gift. What's the next step for the series? I am assuming it's a series because this is The Human Life in book one. So where do you plan to go with the whole concept?
So the series right now is 7 books, and I've just finished the second book, book 2, An Open Heart. And book 2 deals with emotions and what emotions are and how emotions affect us and how to work effectively in a mindful way with our emotions. And then from there, I see a book on relationships, on communication, how to communicate effectively, on movement, and not necessarily exercise, but just movement and moving your body and why that's important. And then nutrition. And environmentalism, I think, is a huge part because we're intimately connected to our environment. So again, all the things, the sort of points on this wheel of what makes holistic health and makes us whole and healthy human beings. And all of my friends have been trying to find that information as they're older. And they come up against maybe a really big thing that happens in their lives. So everything falls apart, or they're really stressed out. Then they sort of start to find the pieces and see where they've been missing. And my hope is that we can begin to let our children know about this, how to take care of this body and this mind and these emotions and this awareness that we are right from the start, so that when things do fall apart for them as they get older, because they will, that's how life goes, they have the tools already. They're already there for them. They don't have to go and seek them out or think that they have failed in some major way, that they know that this is how this goes.
It's interesting. And as you said, Tim, you know, you're at the age you are just learning about some of this stuff. And I remember I was struck by this explanation of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system that I got maybe like 15 years ago, where talking about why we shouldn't eat in our cars and why we shouldn't eat standing up, why we should sit down and relax at the dinner table, and that, you know, part of the issue with even obesity in this country is because we're eating on the run all the time and it's never received by our bodies in the correct way. So I remember that being an aha moment for me, you know, after I was already an adult, and it makes sense. But talk a little bit about that. You talk in your book about the sympathetic nervous system, and how do you go about explaining that?
That was such a really empowering moment in my life too, one of those aha moments, like you're saying, that when I learned that what I was thinking, how I was caught up in that thought process or lost in it unconsciously affected my nervous system. And so if I was feeling anxiety or fear or nervousness, that had a lot to do with what I was thinking. And so when the chattering mind is just going, you know, we're unconscious of it, it's rolling the show, it's taking the body along for the ride, even if the thoughts are positive thoughts per se, your system is moved more into that flight or fight system. And so that will create you to, you know, tense the muscles around your eyes, to clench your jaw, to press your tongue against the roof of your mouth. Your breath will be shallow. Sometimes you'll even go about your whole day holding your breath. And that just is, it's this loop. So you have these thoughts that are maybe anxiety or grasping, like, oh, this is so good. I want this. I want this. I want this. That tips you towards flight or fight. The physical symptoms get on board. And then you're just stuck in this loop. Yeah, you're just going in this loop. And over time, that wears you down mentally, physically, emotionally. Whereas mindfulness, when we begin to bring some consciousness to that loop, we can change it. We can say, oh, yeah, there's my grasping, or there's my worry. Okay, that's worry. Oh, and I see with that worry, I'm clenching my jaw, I'm pressing my tongue. Okay, I know my tools. I can deepen my breath. I can relax my face. I can be with my worry in a really mindful way. So it's not about getting rid of it or thinking it's bad or trying to change it or even put a positive spin on it. It's bravely opening to what is and consciously being with that. And ironically, that's what begins to shift it. And that's where I think real change for health and well-being overall for this human life come in.
How about the illustrations, Becca? I mean, they're just wonderful. How did you come across your illustrator, and what how did you choose these particular illustrations? Because they're just wonderful.
Yeah, so Brooke Kemmerer, she was sort of a friend of a friend. She was living in Heber, and she is a mama with young kids too, like me. And then she moved back to Jackson, Wyoming, where she's from. And as I started to put the book together and knew that it was going to be illustrated, and I posted a Facebook post that said, hey guys, does anybody know of an illustrator? I'm looking for an illustrator. And just a slew of friends and family were saying, oh, this person, or I am. And Brooke got on and said, oh, Becca, I would love to illustrate it. And so I sent her a copy of the manuscript. It resonated with her. And it was great working with her. I sort of had bullet points of where I thought illustrations should go and what they should look like. But as she got into it and had her own interpretations, she thought that, you know, she had her own input as to where things would go. So it was really great collaborating with her and just seeing the book begin to get a life of its own. I really love her illustrations too.
And how about the quotes that you start each chapter with?
The quotes that I start each chapter with have just been really meaningful quotes for me in my life, and quotes that I have used many times in my teaching with students.
They're
and
all
clients.
Very familiar, and they're wonderful.
Yeah. And I just think that they're a great way that you can sort of go to the book and just find one little snippet if you need it that day.
Mm-hmm.
So I know you wrote it for kids, but you know, I'm sitting here going, this is real. I get my copy? Because I have a feeling that there's more than just kids who are going to benefit from this book.
That's my hope. I mean, I totally am. I love to read. I always say I'm just a big dork that loves to read and research and learn. And I love young adult books and novels, and I love illustrated books, and I think I love reading books at night with my girls more than they probably do. And so my hope is that, again, parents will be involved and teachers and counselors, and that they too will get a lot out of the book in the series as well.
It's an easy book, five chapters, just about 40 pages. And where can our listeners find this book?
Well, so you can find it in any store. We'll have it here at Expanding Heart. Atticus is already carrying it. In Salt Lake, the King's English and the Golden Braid are carrying it in Barnes & Noble. And then you can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble online, and Indie Books online. So if you go to my website, kidsuserguide.com, there's a tab for the book that would lead you to many of those places.
I think you should put a little instruction on the cover that says something to the effect that parents must read this book to their children. I'm with you. One of the greatest thrills I had raising my kids was reading to them, and I carried that through reading to classes at the Colby School for years and just loved it myself. It was all, you know, not all, but a big part of it was the joy that I got out of reading. And when you read something like this to your kids, there's benefit to everyone. This is a really great idea for families.
Mm-hmm. What do you think my college kid's going to say when he comes
home?
When
you read to him?
For Christmas, and I say, listen, you're laying down next to me, we're reading this book. I mean,
you know really, what? He's actually going to love it.
He probably will. I mean, really, it's a great piece that we all need. So, Becca Brenner, thank you so much for coming by the studios today, and best of luck in your endeavor. I didn't hear you say that the book's at Dolly's. Is it Dolly's yet?
I'm not sure if it's going to be at Dolly's, but I know for certain it's at Atticus right now and Expanding Heart.
Okay, yeah. Very good. Becca, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, you guys.
And this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back with Emmy Award-winning writer and producer Eric Kaplan. He's going to talk about another existential question, the existence of Santa, just in time for the holidays.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, president of Grand Valley Banks, Park City Branch, longtime supporter of KPCW. Our team can help you with all of your lending needs, from basic to complex loans. Our loan decisions are made locally. We have two branches in Heber and Midway and one branch in Park City. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with Tim Henney. We were just speaking with Rebecca Brenner. She goes by Becca. Her book is The Kid's User Guide to a Human Life, Book One, An Open Mind. What a nice conversation that was. Well, you've heard of Futurama or the Big Bang Theory, right? Well, how about The Late Show with David Letterman or Flight of the Conchords? Our next guest has written for all of them. In fact, he's an Emmy Award-winning writer, and he's also producer of The Big Bang Theory. He's not quite like Sheldon Cooper, the protagonist of The Big Bang Theory, but a little bit. He's inquisitive, sharp, and he loves to explore. But he's probably more fun to talk to. He's on a quest to explore one of life's biggest quandaries. Does Santa exist? It's a philosophical investigation, and the title of his new book, Does Santa Exist? It's a little more than a wild ride to the point of everything. It begins with an investigation of paradoxes in our day-to-day lives. It's written to appeal to readers at all levels of philosophical curiosity. I just love it. I love the thought of does Santa exist, because for so many, it does. But we'll see what Eric Kaplan has to talk about. And good morning to you, Eric Kaplan. Thanks for joining us on The Mountain Life.
My pleasure. Nice to be here.
Great. Great to have you.
What's your last name? I want to call up your image on Google so I know who I'm talking to.
Oh, very good. Lynn Ware Peak, W-A-R-E.
Oh, I found you. I just found you. Lynn Ware Peak.
She's hard to miss, Eric.
And Tim Henney, you should see a photo of us together.
Here you are. Okay, I can see you guys. The Mountain Life, KPCW. Hi. Okay, that's much more normal.
That's us.
These are disembodied voices.
Our mouths moving.
It would be no fairer, because we've seen your picture.
That. I'm doing that.
I'm looking at you, too.
Okay, terrific. Okay, beautiful.
Okay, great. Well, Eric...
Not that I'm beautiful. No, the situation is beautiful.
Well, this particular photo of you is probably my most favorite. So it's
beautiful.
A good one.
Okay,
yes,
good.
It's beautiful.
It is stunning.
This is the thing that hits me. You are very educated. Talk a little bit about your educational evolution.
You know, I was very into reading as a kid. I was a bit of a social isolate, and I read a lot. And there was also a lot of talk over the dinner table. My mom was a high school biology teacher, and my dad was a lawyer in a low-income neighborhood. And there was a lot of like needing to defend your opinion and explain yourself. So I got very interested I kind of took to thinking and I took to reading. And I think it's kind of a helpful activity. Because it's a fairly peaceful way of interacting with other human beings to try and understand what they think and to share reflections with them, and that's something that I enjoy, and I sort of enjoy it even more in the kind of unformalized way than in school. I mean, school is fine, and I'm pro school, but I do think like the best place to pursue your education is wherever you happen to be.
Eric, how does this unfold with your family now? I mean, it kind of sounds like, you know, those discussions at the dinner table where you were put in a position of defending yourself or creating arguments, and that leads you into logic and philosophy. And how does that play out later in life for you currently, let's say, with your parents? The reason I ask is because my son was a philosophy major at NYU, and I have a very difficult time keeping up with him. And he eventually...
Oh, has he become a wise guy?
Well, he eventually uncovers the fact that I am an imposter and that I am just following his discussion and really not contributing anything. Are you kinder to your parents?
No. To my parents... Well, I certainly could never defeat my father in an argument. He's a wily one. One time to make some money, I was writing questions for the law school aptitude test, the LSAT. I was making $85 a question, and I brought them into my dad. He would sit all night watching television and type legal forms. And I showed him the questions, and almost without looking up, he just got them all right immediately. And these were these kind of tricky logic questions, like which of the following would be less likely to be untrue if the following were neither not true or rather than true or something like that, you know, just deliberate mind puzzlers or brain teasers. And he had no problem with them. So that's not something that I run into. I wonder if your son might have learned to come up with statistical tricks to make the better cause seem the lesser.
No, I don't think so.
What is he talking to you about?
I don't think so.
No,
I think
he's just outstripped you. Well,
yeah, that's much more a difference between me and your father. It's the difference in the fathers, I think, that we're dealing with here.
Well, can you wrestle him? I mean, you got to have something that you're better than him at.
Yeah, I can wrestle.
Maybe you're more popular. Are you more popular? I bet you've got a talk show and he's some philosophy.
Yes. Yes, I have him in the wrestling and the popularity.
Okay, those are very important. That's good.
What a good thing we've spoken to you now. You figured out all of Tim's problems. Oh, very good. So, you know,
I could tell you can wrestle from the picture. You seem like a hale and hearty individual.
Yes, I have that going for me. But that doesn't help when you're, you know, exposed as that imposter. And that's one of the things about your book that I really like, because you deal with what I consider myself to be of average intelligence. And I've always struggled with philosophy, because it seems to me any avenue you go down, you eventually hit a dead end, because nothing is true. There are no fundamental truths. And once you get there, it's like, well, what is the point of exploring an inquiry, you know, an examined life? Well, if I'm going to get to there are no truths, what's the point? Why don't we just start with there are no truths? So philosophy has been extremely frustrating for me, and I get exposed as masquerading by my son, but I read your book and I actually get somewhere.
Well, I think the idea that philosophy is not supposed to be wisdom. It's supposed to be the love of wisdom. That's the meaning of the term. So the idea is we're not sages. There are no human beings, as far as we know, who are sages, who have become truly wise. But there might be something to be gained by exploring our ignorance, so to speak. And that sounds very, very like maybe frou-frou, but I mean, what it could mean is, well, what are the different things? Maybe we don't know the final answer, but what are the different ways we can think of things? Maybe there's not an infinite number of them. Maybe there's like four big ones, you know? Or maybe there are certain problems that we all get into, and it's nice to know that we all get into those problems. Like one of the big problems that people get into in philosophy is freedom versus determinism. And people are like, wow, in certain contexts, it certainly seems like science can tell us what's going to happen next. But then when I'm actually living my life and I need to decide, do I want to steal the money or do I want to let the people have the money, it's kind of up to me. Now, how could it be that it's both up to me and determined? Now, for my money, no one has a good answer to that question. It's just a very, very, very hard question. Maybe there'll never be a good answer to the question. I've never seen one that satisfied me. But I think I got somewhere by at least knowing that those are those two options. So then when things come up like, you know, if somebody like take the issue of anorexia. People are like, whoa, why are these girls killing themselves by starving themselves? Or should we let them do it? Should we jump in and force feed them? Like, wow, what are we supposed to do about that? At least we can be like, wow, that's a hard issue because it seems to be at the middle of this very difficult terrain, which is the intersection between freedom and determinism. So we can be like, yeah, it makes sense that we're confused by that. It's confusing. And then maybe that's helpful, too, is like you're saying, well, I haven't found that one bedrock, which is completely unconfusing, but maybe I can kind of explore my environment a little bit and figure out what places are confusing and what places are less confusing.
So this leads us
maybe
to...
Maybe your son will think that's a giant dodge. I don't know.
Probably.
Since it came out of your mouth, I don't think he will. If it had come out of my mouth, it would be a giant dodge.
Yeah, Eric Kaplan
said. Well, but
that's
the thing is he has to defeat his dad to find some space on this little planet for him.
Well, he's done that.
So, okay. Next. Get a girlfriend.
Oh yeah, there we go. So when your book appeared on my desk and I saw the title of it, and I would imagine that a lot of people, and especially around the station here, everyone has looked at that book, and it's interesting what their comments are. And I think that everyone has a theory that is not maybe what you'd think. And I'm wondering, as you've presented your book or the title of your book, have you had some interesting responses that either follow or don't follow at all what the philosophical inquiry is?
Well, I gave a copy to Mike Tyson, and he was like, damn, man, we knew Santa Claus didn't exist because we were poor.
Oh.
So that was interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then other people, I spoke to somebody who was like, wow, I want to share this with pastors. Because it helps talk about religious faith. So I think there, yeah, people kind of hook on to that issue of sort of faith and belief underlying the question of the literal existence or non-existence of Santa. So I do get a lot of interesting responses, and that's kind of like, you know, I like people to pay attention to me. I feel like sort of the need for attention is sort of a Darwinian thing that as infants, if no one pays attention to us, we'll die because we're so helpless. We're not like, you know, rattlesnakes that can just go off into the grass and live. So I like attention, and it doesn't need to be necessarily people saying, I agree with you. It could be, I think it's infuriating how wrong you are, and I find that interesting as well. I think that those all kind of responses are cool.
So does your book in some way help someone, you know, I think of a philosopher as being sort of in the same realm as a scientist who, you know, who needs proof and can handle a theory but needs proof. Does it help them understand people that have blind faith or not even blind faith, but just, you know, religious belief?
It should, because one of the things I feel like, you know, maybe philosophy is like slightly different from science because the question of what is proof and what we should, when we need it and when we don't, is a fair question in philosophy. So I think you can certainly say there are things that we deal with, like freedom or the self or love, that we cannot prove, but they seem to be part of our lives, part of our tools for dealing with our lives. So I think it's certainly, to my way of thinking, sometimes in America it feels to me that we're divided into these two camps. There are religious people who think the secular people are wicked, and then there are secular people who think the religious people are dopes. And I think both sides are wrong on that. That I think the secular people are not wicked. They're actually motivated by certain moral imperatives like freedom and justice, which are moral and not just these godlessness. And I think the religious people are not dopes either. I think they're trying to carve out an area of human meaning which is separate from the scientific worldview. But just because someone's doing that doesn't mean that they're a dope. I mean, I think everybody does that in some way, because the scientific worldview, if you take a close look at it, doesn't really have room for a self or things being good or bad, not obviously. So I think that both sides have something to value in the other and have more in common than maybe they seem to when they're engaged in a debate.
Eric, let's talk about one of the tools that you're currently a practitioner of, and I think this is just fascinating because you go from the realm that you're in also, which is getting your PhD at UC Berkeley currently, but you're also applying your philosophical perspective to the realm of humor. And that's an amazing tool mm-hmm. for people dealing with their lives. And how does that relate?
Yeah. Well, I think about the fact that, like, I had some friends once who had a pet pig, and they loved this pig, but then also they ate the pig for breakfast next to eggs.
Didn't Homer Simpson do that in an episode?
He did it with a lobster.
Yeah, he did. Pinchy.
He had a lobster named Pinchy, and he was taking a bath with Pinchy, and the bath got hot, and Pinchy ended up suddenly smelling very delicious. And then he was eating Pinchy, and he was like, "Oh, Pinchy, I miss you so much. Oh, God, you're so delicious. You're so delicious. Oh, Pinchy, I miss you." So he had a split attitude towards Pinchy the lobster. And people say that, you shouldn't eat dogs, but people have told me that the pig is as sensitive a being as a dog and as smart. And it's almost like we don't give credit to the pig for being sensitive, because it's a nocturnal beast, so it has a very well-developed nose, but not very well-developed eyes. So when you look at the face of the pig, it's got these little squinky eyes, and you don't love it as much as the big eyes of the dog. I mean, although the cow has beautiful eyes, and people have no problem eating the cow, so I don't know what's happening there. But I do think that there's something funny about the approach people take to animals. One of the things I talk about in the book is, like if the body of someone, if you love them, right, that you're saying, like, if supposing I'm in love with Marilyn Monroe or whatever, who's a more current reference than Marilyn Monroe? Who's an actress these days?
You're asking the two wrong people. Who's famous? Beyonce.
Okay.
Beyonce.
Well, let's stick with Marilyn Monroe. Okay. Beyonce. Okay. So you want to kiss Beyonce, presumably, if you're in love with Beyonce. That means you're going to be drinking some of her saliva. And people are like, okay, that's cool. I want to do that. And you're like, well, what if she cries on top of me? Cries with happiness, seeing that I'm safe. So you're getting these secretions from her eyes all over your face. Well, that's cool, too. I love her. Well, what if she's crying so much that stuff is coming out of her nose? Well, that's cool, too. If it's okay that it's stuff coming out of her eyes, if it's coming out of her nose, it's the same old. And you're like, she's going to be away for a long time, and the only souvenir you can have is some feces of hers in Lucite, and you can keep that. And people are like, well, I don't know. That seems kind of like a crazy idea. And if somebody did that, you'd say, well, that's a ridiculous, insane person. But how come? How come? Because you like this person's body so much, and that came out of their body or their fingernail clippings, So that's weird. Somebody who was really kissing Beyonce's fingernail clippings, you'd think, is a loon. So we seem to have this paradoxical attitude towards other people's bodies when we love them. I mean, and like another thing is like this. There's a joke that I quote from Robert Schimmel about death, and this is, it's all about stuff that's true. He says, "My son got cancer, and I thought that was really bad. But then I got cancer, and I realized what it was for something to be bad." And it's kind of interesting because we tend to say, like, the right attitude is, I feel much worse if something bad happens to you than if something happens to me. But then there's this other attitude, which the comedian there talks about, where, no, I think it's much worse if something happens to me than if it happens to you. So how do we put those two things together? It's weird. It's funny, even. And then you can say, well, ideally, we want to be like a saint and only want good things to happen to other people and not to us. But if they weren't good things, why would we even want them to happen to other people? If we don't want them, why should we want them to have them? It's all very confusing, I think.
That's where I come down. It's all very confusing.
It's all very confusing. But as long as you can beat up your son, you can get through the day.
There we go. Eric Kaplan. Hey, maybe next conversation we'll talk about Santa.
Eric. That sounds great. Ho, ho, ho.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Eric Kaplan.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Wow.
A lot of stories about our kids.
Yeah. Eric Kaplan, I think he's my new hero. I have never pictured that those in a philosophical pursuit about life in general would be that funny.
Yeah.
He's really humorous.
He is. Which, yeah, for philosophers, I think that's a unique characteristic, unique to Eric Kaplan.
Right. I mean, imagine. So he's getting his PhD in philosophy at Berkeley right now, which is, I think, again, that's funny. We talked about that he has all of these successes as an Emmy Award-winning writer and
right,
a producer.
Right, for comedy shows.
Right, but he's still going to go get that PhD.
Fly to the Conchords. I mean, and that's what it is. I wish we could have gotten into who his favorite comedians are, because I can just imagine it's Louis C.K. and people like that,
right,
who weave in something much more than just slapstick comedy. There's an element of philosophy in their comedy, which is what makes it kind of, I think, smart comedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absurd comedy as
absurd
well.
Absurd and smart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That thing about Beyonce was, wow. That's good. But also, I haven't gone all the way through his book, but really this question about Santa is so wonderful, because in my mind, Santa fully exists. I never had to have a conversation with my children. They, Santa exists in our family.
Well, we had a small family trauma over that when Scott demanded to know if Santa really exists, and we, being the parents who wanted to tell our children the truth, broke it to him in front of Thea, who then broke down crying, saying she was like 6 or 7, that she really wanted Santa to exist. She knew he didn't, but didn't really want us to tell her.
Yeah, we should have done a spoiler alert. Turn off the radio if you're... Anyway, Santa, alive and well. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I want to thank our guests today, Becca Brenner, along with Eric Kaplan, of course. And thank our underwriters, Park City Bonanza Instacare, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank and Heber Valley Bank, and Park Meadows Country Club. We'll be right back.
The Glittertind at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glittertind restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist's seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glittertind serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
Thanks for joining us for The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. And you can always access archive shows at kpcw.org. You're listening to KPCW Park City. Time now for news.